We're talking talking today about prospects for the future. When I put that title on the announcement board out here, it just seemed to me that it was the appropriate thing to do. I had four sessions, and I had I was taught someplace along the line that it's a good idea to have 3 points and then have a summary, and I had the 3 points up there without any difficulty. And the summary, rather than just calling the summary, call it prospects for the future. I didn't know till after Vespers last night what these prospects were, but that's not true. I'd like to make 3 points. We're speculating about the future. And, well, everybody has to understand that this is all speculation. Nobody knows. I have a colleague who says that the best way to know about the future is to subscribe to Vogue magazine and see whether hemlines are rising or, what is it, falling? Dropping. Or another way to do that is to listen to the radio a lot and to see how music is developing. I take that one somewhat seriously because I think there are certain tendencies in musical forms that give indication of the shape of the future. Paul Simon said that one of the differences between our time and earlier times is that the musicians, the composers in an earlier time, the composers of popular songs, were piano players for the most part, pianists. And because of that, they started out with melodies. More recently, we've had guitar players who are composers, and they start out with chords, chord formations, and then they add the melodies later. And he says the melodies are not very sophisticated. You know, he's one of those himself, so he's not poor-mouthing what is going on. But there's a great difference between the music of the 60s and 70s and the music that came before. Anyway, now that we're warmed up a little bit, I'd like to suggest three kinds of tendencies that I think will develop into larger movements or phenomena in the future. And by future, I really mean the immediate future. You know, I think these things are developing now, and they will become larger. These are not the only things that are developing, but they are significant trends. The first one is the steady increase in contemplative religion or mystical religion. Now, we've been talking about mysticism kind of roundabout in the time that we've had together. I want to say two things about it. I feel a little bit like this is that our era is similar to the era that Petrarch talked about when he went up to the top of Mount Ventoux just prior to the beginnings of the Renaissance and exclaimed, you know, what a world I see dawning. Because there are people within our culture who will argue in the following way, that civilization has been off course for some time. Many people will say that. Houston Smith, who's a very good analyst of contemporary events, I think, thinks that civilization has been off course since the time of Descartes, for a lot of reasons we can't get into here, but since the 17th century. But there are some monks who say that civilization has been off course since the 12th century. And they believe that the Reformation was a necessity, but a kind of tragic necessity. And we'll say, as Jaroslav Pelikan said, that Catholics have not always recognized the necessity of the Reformation, and Protestants have not always recognized the tragedy of it, because it split Christendom for the first time. And there's a kind of growing development, which I'm partly responsible for, I guess, to see Lutheranism, for example, as something similar to the development of the Franciscan order or the development of the Dominican order, as a kind of something within the church that gives emphasis to a particular style or a particular way of reading the gospel, which may not have been intended to be a church in the beginning, but became that because of the kind of conflict situation which it was posed over against more mainline Christianity. That's a very kind of wild thought, but that's that will be coming into prominence. And there are some who say that what we will find in the next years is a return to the 12th century, to a position that comes closer to those positions that were prevalent prior to the time of Martin Luther. I was suggesting that in the Vespers last night, that the reference to the Pythagorean vision was also a reference to the Franciscan spirituality. Now, the song we sang at Vespers was the words of that were written by Francis of Assisi, the love of nature, the love of the kind of unity of all things. That was there prior to the time that things got fragmented, but the fragmentation has only been with us for, say, 5 or 6 centuries. Well, anyway, along those lines, we will probably expect to find in the future an increase in contemplative sensitivities, in meditation, in mystical awarenesses, in the sort of exploration of the interior life, the return of prayer and practice of the spiritual disciplines. Lots of people, even in this community, have asked me, just as we're sitting at table or walking around the trails here, what are we to do, and how can we practice some of the things we've been talking about when we talk about the monastic viewpoint? And that's an indication to me that that there is interest in this subject, and the interest is growing. Now, I want to be autobiographical. I guess I'm autobiographical at all times, but I want to be deliberately autobiographical here, because I think my experience in this regard is probably similar to many of yours. I had trained in the Lutheran Church, brought up on Scandinavian models of piety, primarily Swedish. I had two means of access to mystical religion, neither of which worked. The first one was through philosophy, and mysticism was presented to me in school as sort of bad philosophy. You know, it's the kind of philosophy that it's extraordinary knowledge. It's the kind of knowledge you come to by irrational or non-rational means, not regular knowledge, not the kind of knowledge that for which one can provide certification, either logical certification or empirical verification, but it was sort of extrasensory, extra-rational. And that has to be poo-pooed by the philosophers. And the only time you'd ever get into that, you know, take that sort of thing seriously, is if the more regular ways of acquiring knowledge had sort of fallen apart. So that wasn't any good. And people would say, oh, he's just a mystic. You don't take him seriously, he's a mystic. That means he's a dreamer. He's a visionary. He's occult. He'd be interested in apocalyptic things, far out things. Well, that wasn't any good. So, I mean, from that point of view, you're trained to be suspicious of anything very mystical. The other side was even more compelling, and that was the religious side. And from that point of view, I think I was taught, nobody did this deliberately, it's just the way you pick up these things living in the places where I lived. I was taught that mysticism was sort of cop-out Christianity. Real Christianity, red-blooded Christianity, was incarnational Christianity, and that meant involvement in concrete situations, just as God didn't stay out there someplace in some other world, but came into this world and identified with the needs and aspirations and frustrations and fears and anxieties of human beings, became human. And mysticism, so this accounting went, is just the contrary to that, just the opposite of that. It's otherworldly, it's not this worldly. It's not concrete, it's not specific, it doesn't mix itself up in all of the things that most of us are mixed up in most of the time, but it's like those monks, it goes off someplace, it's out there, it's precious, disjointed from the way the world actually is. And that wasn't very complimentary either. No one would want to be a mystic then, because that would mean that probably that you couldn't make a go of it in the scheme of things that all of us have to address, and you found an alternative, but the alternative was a poor substitute for the real thing. So I didn't take any of this very seriously until well, I don't need to say when, I guess it's been rather recent, in the last 5 years. But then I discovered three things about mysticism. First of all, that in saying that it's non-rational, that doesn't really mean that there's anything wrong with it, because there are all sorts of things that are non-rational, and it could very well be that the majority of experiences that we have lay outside that range of things for which rational certification can be supplied. And it might only mean that it's, like we were suggesting yesterday, it's more intuitive than rational, depends more on sensitivities, sensibility, on the senses, upon hearing and seeing. In other words, to suggest that it isn't philosophy doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with it, because there are lots of things that aren't philosophy that are really good. In fact, I have more questions about philosophy right now. In fact, that's what's going on in the schools. The philosophers are having a terrible time of getting any kind of following, and are becoming narrower and narrower in their scope. I don't want to poor mouth philosophers either, but the first objection to mysticism really doesn't hold up. And then, but the second one isn't so bad either, because, well, there's lots of evidence here. The fourth gospel, the gospel according to John, is very much a mystical writing, as are the epistles of John. There's mysticism in the New Testament. I and my Father are one. Or St. Paul talks about this mystery that has been hidden during the ages and is now made known, been revealed. And the mystery is Christ in you, the hope of glory. See, not beliefs about Christ, not doctrines, but Christ in you, the presence of God. Or as Brother Lawrence says, practicing the presence of God within. Well, that's mysticism. And that, another confirmation or another sort of selling point on mysticism's behalf, if you want to do it in this crass way, is that most of the mystics that we know about were also social reformers. Mother Teresa is a mystic. Thomas Merton was a mystic. And none of them, the ones that we try to emulate, or the ones that we hold up as illustrations or examples of what mysticism should be in its best sense, these people are not folks who have withdrawn from the world, but they've been involved, they're very much involved, you know, in the center of things. At the same time, they have something to offer, because they always realize that things as they cannot be exhausted by what they are, but refer beyond themselves to the meaning that they have. Well, I don't want to push that side of it as much as what I'd like to say next. I've come to understand that mysticism is not at all philosophy, but it has its roots in the life of prayer. It feeds on prayer. Its resources are prayer. It's a refinement, a cultivation of the life of prayer. And rather than being philosophical in its orientation, it appears to be much more romantic in its character. We talked the other day about the prominence of the Song of Songs in the mystical tradition, and the Song of Songs being the Song of Solomon, being a Hebrew love poem. And that particular analogy is used to describe the relationship between God and the soul. Now, it has that kind of characteristic, and that's very different from the one that I was trained to look for. I'm only suggesting this, that we're going to see an increasing awareness of this. There will be some difficulty with it in the Lutheran Church, because Lutherans are not strangers to mysticism, but they haven't called it that. They've called it pietism. And there was Carl Olof Rosenius, 19th century in Sweden. There's also the Haugi tradition among the Norwegians, which have been very pietistic. And that has led to some difficulty. I think what will happen in the Lutheran Church, and it should happen, somebody should help us do this, is that the basis for the grounding for pietistic religion needs to be expanded. The grounding, the basis for mystical religion, Lutheran mystical religion called pietism, was very narrow, became increasingly narrow. And as I suggested yesterday, pietism became a divisive force within the Lutheran Church. And that wasn't very good, wasn't very healthy. But we can't avoid it, and we need to expand the groundwork out of which this kind of tendency comes. Second point. In the future, we're also going to be seeing the the rise of the tradition of the spiritual master, the spiritual master. Now, some places this is referred to as the spiritual fathers. But it's not only spiritual fathers, it's going to be spiritual mothers too, spiritual fathers and mothers. I'll give an example of what I have in mind. This was last December, I was at a meeting at Harvard University, which ended on a Friday evening. And instead of coming home that night, I did as I've done frequently. I rented a car and drove from Cambridge, Massachusetts, out to Spencer, Massachusetts, where there's a Trappist Abbey. I'd never been to this one, and it's regarded as a monastic showpiece, a very fine, kind of elegant place. Wonderfully done brick buildings and oriental rugs and all. It's a work of aesthetic beauty. And I'd had an appointment there to meet a monk who had just returned from Mount Athos. He's the only Western monk in 8 centuries to be invited to live among the Orthodox monks in Mount Athos, a great tribute to him, I think. A man named Father Basil Pennington, about 6'5", must weigh 240 or 215, with very large hands. I never met.
Excuse me, sir, but we don't all have hearing aids. I can't turn your volume up. You have to
okay.
Keep it up.
Thank you.
Please.
Anyway, I was in Spencer, Massachusetts, trying to come to terms with the work of the Trappists who live in the abbey there. And along the way, see, this was winter time, and we Californians don't experience much winter unless we travel away from there. The snow on the ground. I stood outside a little bit outside this abbey before going in, and kind of looked up at the stars. And I remembered the time when my father took me across a school ground in Nebraska and pointed out the meaning of the constellations. We looked up, and he said, "There's Orion the Hunter, and there's a Great Dipper, Big Dipper, and North Star." And I was trying to find all these things. And I was thinking that I'd been gone for quite a while, and I was missing my son considerably that evening, because I wish that there had been a chance to do the same thing for him. And I always feel a little bit guilty about taking extra time to visit these places. Well, anyway, that's just kind of background. I got inside this place, and this monk took me down to his room, where he had a bottle of Matus and some crackers and some very fine cheese, and began talking about the rise of mystical religion in the West. And then he told me that he knew the Maharishi. He'd gotten to know the Maharishi well. And I asked him what he thought about the Maharishi. And he said he respected him a great deal. And then he gave me a theory about why the Maharishi has caught on, and not only the Maharishi, but all of the Eastern gurus that have come into our culture. It's a theory. I'm not sure I believe, but I think it's kind of interesting. He said that parents in the last generation have not been able, because of the tremendous ferment in our society, have not been able to give their children what their children desire, what their children need. And what their children need, he says, is a combination of the accepting kind of love, the kind of love that will never, I can't find the words here. It's a combination of love and authority, just firm authority and total acceptance, undeniable acceptance. And he says that they have not been able to do this, but the Maharishi does that. The Maharishi will meet young people and say that whatever they've done up to that point is all right. They don't have to apologize for it. It's exactly the way it should have been for them. But beyond that, the Maharishi will tell them exactly what to do. Well, he'll give out, directives or what they ought to be doing next. Now, I know the second part to be true, because I've been with students who've come under my training and then have gone to the Maharishi and come back with haircuts and jobs, and you say, how did it all happen? A fellow named Keith. 3 years of, I almost wanted to give up my profession, because he had 3 years of courses at UC Santa Barbara, and one summer in Colorado, and he came back, and he was a changed man. And I said, "Whatever happened, Keith?" He said, well, he told me exactly what to do. And he believed it. He believed he should be doing that, and he did it, and it worked. Now, this monk in Massachusetts says that there is a place for the role of the spiritual father in our society. Not just the Eastern gurus, but the Western traditions have a lot to teach as well. And he was talking about how Western monks ought to take on the role of being spiritual masters. So, and then he got kind of, you know, carried away with all this, and he says, you need a spiritual master. He said, do you have a spiritual master? And I said, well, I, you know, my feeling was I didn't want to tell him even if I had one, and I suppose I did, but I didn't call him that quite. And he said, well, you need one. And then I turned it around, and I said, do you ever understand yourself to be a spiritual father? He said, yes, of course. Yes, of course. A lot of people have come to him, and he is learning the art of spiritual mastership. He's learning how to teach people how to pray, how to meditate, how to center. And he went on to say that there were a lot of skills involved in this, but they were not unlike the skills that a doctor has to learn, a physician. That there are certain rhythms and patterns to the human heart, and the very sensitive person in listening to conversation or getting to know someone well can understand how those rhythms or those oscillations, those pulsations are going, can discern the pattern of movement, can tell at what stage a person is in his own spiritual development, and there is a role for the spiritual master. Well, I began thinking about that because I've gotten to know a lot of pastors, and I have a feeling that many, many pastors were like I was when I first went to the seminary. We went there, first of all, I think for religious reasons. That is, we became, you know, the pathway might have been this, that we became attracted to the Christian faith, compelled by the Christian faith to take up a vocation, full-time vocation in the church. And then along the way, sort of got into things like administration and education and all the things that are necessary to keep the institutions going. But the primary commitment was to the sort of the core of things, which was to the life of God, the way that the life of God manifests itself in the human heart or in human relationships. But so much of that gets sort of pushed aside because of the prevalence of all these other things. So what I'm suggesting is that if Father Basil has his way, those of us who are not pastors but are in congregations may be asking our pastors to become more like spiritual leaders, spiritual masters. And if that's the case, most pastors are not trained to do that at all. And the seminary training prepares you for almost everything else, but not that. There'll be pressure upon the seminaries to do that kind of thing. When there's pressure upon the seminaries to do that, that pressure is growing at the moment. There will also be pressure to teach courses in mystical religion where people can learn those kinds of things. And that's going to change the face of things. And I think it's going to change it rather quickly. Third point, and then I'm going to say it all here today because it's my last shot, and then I'll give you a chance to respond. Along with these two things, I think there's going to be in the future, and it's growing now, a rising awareness of the interdependence of Eastern and Western religions. The religions of the East are going to come into greater prominence in the West. It may be that the traffic will go the other way, you know, from west to east as well. What we're finding in our culture, I think, is maybe for the first time in the history of the West is facing the West, but from interests that developed in the East. The thing about the spiritual master is not, first of all, a Western concept, but it's something that has grown up in the East and is focusing attention on its counterpart in the West. Now, I'm kind of writing a book on this as I travel about, and if you will allow me, I'd like to read two pages of carefully written typescript, because I think I can do it quicker this way than if I try to say it. I guess you'll have to allow me to do it. If you don't allow me to do it, I don't know how you'll show it, except get up and walk out. But what I've tried to do is to show something about the basis for the influence that Thomas Merton and Merton, the kind of Merton approach will have in our society. And this is a look back 10 years. If this doesn't go well, I'll stop reading it, but let me try. 1978 marks the 10th year since the death of Thomas Merton. Certainly no one could have known in December 1968, when Merton died in Bangkok, Thailand, that the next 10 years would see the arrival of the new contemplative era in religion. For December 1968 was a time of transition. It was a period of profound political upheaval, social, cultural adjustment, institutional change. The Vietnam War was becoming burden, embarrassment, and incontrovertible tragedy. The student protest movement had gathered momentum. The counterculture was in full dress. The Johnson administration was giving way to the reascendancy of Richard Nixon, who in turn was issuing manifestos regarding the aspirations of his first term of presidential office. In the electoral process immediately preceding, the country had become well acquainted with Eugene McCarthy, then again with Hubert Humphrey. It was on January 20th, 1961, that President John F. Kennedy had declared to the nation and to the world that, quote, the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans who are willing to pay any price, bear any burden, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. Now a half decade had passed since President Kennedy had been assassinated. That's 1968. 6 months had passed since the murder of his brother Robert, more than 8 months since the killing of Martin Luther King, the leader of the civil rights movement. The nation was in a state of prolonged shock. There was turmoil, confusion, but no absence of large resolve. Looking back, Peter Tauber, in a book called The Last Best Hope, referred to 1968 as an extraordinary moment in the world's life, another in the periodic high tides in the culture and politics of men, a year when revolution was itself the natural order, when politics and culture combined and altered each other. All of this was prior to the experience of Watergate. It was well ahead of the Kissinger era of foreign diplomacy. It was prior to George McGovern's bid for the presidency. Spiro Agnew wasn't yet a household word. Jimmy Carter hadn't yet become governor of Georgia. All this just happened in the last 10 years. Charles de Gaulle was still alive. In religious circles, the vogue was the revised social gospel, at least among Christians, primarily among Protestants. There was much emphasis upon the need to establish the kingdom of God, which is the theological equivalent of the great society on earth. The Catholic world was living in the aftermath of Vatican Council II. The shift to a process orientation was growing in influence. In the churches, Baroque organ music was being replaced by a laid-back, syncopated beat, styled to the capacities of Spanish guitars. Priests and nuns, sometimes together, were leaving the orders, seeking release from their vows. Theologians were counseling their hearers to support the social and political unrest wherever you find it. That was Hans Küng. It was a time of transition. Some of the best lyrics of the time and of the movement were provided by Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, John Lennon, and Paul McCartney. Peter, Paul, and Mary, favorites of the years before, were still singing and performing together, but Mary had announced that she was leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. In the midst of it all, Joan Baez, her soft voice, white teeth, deep moral sensitivity, returned again and again to Sproul Plaza in Berkeley to lend softness, beauty, and direction to the movement. But it was Burt Bacharach who raised the question asked most often, do you know the way to San Jose? All about parking cars and pumping gas. It was December 1968, and the safer, surer, more majestic and predictable worlds of the Barts, the Tillichs, the Niebuhrs, and the Ronners seemed to have passed from the scene. Everywhere, from every quarter, there was something new, as Bob Dylan put it, something new blowing in the wind. On a gentle hillside, a short distance from the walls of the chapel of Gethsemane Abbey near Louisville, Kentucky, a community of Trappist monks gathered to lay the body of Thomas Merton to rest. He had gone to Asia to participate in a number of conferences on religious renewal. He went there to learn from the Asian monks because in these matters, as he said, they were well ahead of their counterparts in the Western world. As he left the airport in San Francisco, he wrote in his diary, I am going home, to the home where I have never been in this body. And then he referred to being at last on my true way after years of waiting and wondering and fooling around. And then he prayed, may I not come back without having settled the great affair. Well, I go on to talk about what happened to Thomas Merton. But I read that to show the amazing contrast that has occurred just in 10 years' time. And in that 10 years' time, Thomas Merton has moved from real obscurity into greater prominence. Now, I don't know if we have time. We don't have time today to do much with Thomas Merton, but there are lots of things which he symbolizes, and I could talk for a long time about Thomas Merton. I talked about Thomas Merton when I was up here 2 years ago. I just want to pick up a couple of things that are kind of unsettled in my mind. Not the sort of traditional things about Merton, but some of the things that have to do with prospects for the future. First one has to do with what happened to Merton when he went to Sri Lanka. It used to be called Ceylon. I want to preface, I've got enough time for this. I want to preface this by saying that if we were looking at Martin Luther today in 1968 to 1978 terms, one way that we might consider him is as a Buddhist. Now that's a wild thing to say, but I really mean it. Because justification by faith, justification by grace through faith, has its counterpart in Buddhist theology regarding the way in which ego and ego anxiety and ego desires frustrates one's relationship to reality. We can't. I can't go any further into that here because we really don't have the time to do it. But I'm sure that somebody soon will come along and, you know, make that kind of suggestion. Now there's this great question about what was Merton doing when he went to Asia. And the best, another thing has to be said is that the book by Thomas Merton called The Asian Journal of Thomas Merton, I think, will perform the role for the next 20-25 years that Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, Letters and Papers from Prison, has performed for the most recent generation. It's because both of these books have such cryptic, enigmatic statements, because both were written by people who may have known that they were dying, but didn't have time, you know, to go back and kind of clean it up and make everything crystal clear. And it could very well be that the commentaries on these books are much more profound than the original writings, because the original writings were so suggestive. At any rate, when Merton saw some Buddhist wood sculptures in Sri Lanka, he said that he had to come all of that way to see these things, and he regarded them as being perfect. He said they're perfect and they lack nothing. They're perfect and they lack nothing. I can give you the exact quotes, but I can't find it here quickly, and I don't want to take the time to look. Now, some scholars, or some people, Merton followers, a number of festivals around the country this year, around the continent, Canada and the United States, on Thomas Merton, because this is the 10th anniversary since his death. The Merton Society is growing up here and there. There's a big festival at Columbia University in December on Thomas Merton. I'm one of the speakers for it. There was one in Vancouver not so long ago. And with people who are working with Merton are trying to figure out, what did Merton mean when he said, it's perfect and it lacks nothing? How could he find anything in the East that would qualify in that way? And these are the kind of suggestions that we're getting from this. Now, and I don't want to like get in a lot of controversy here. I know these are controversial statements. I think they're about as far into the future as I know how to reach. They say that this may have been Merton's understanding. That he went to India, to China, to witness the incarnation of Christ. And the difference is that previous Christians had gone to those places, but they understood that they were bringing Christ to the nations, bringing Christ out of the West into the East. Merton didn't think that, they're saying. Merton wasn't bringing Christ. Merton was going there to meet Christ, to find Christ. Now, how could that ever be? Now, Merton has not written this, so, I mean, not quite in these terms, so nobody knows for sure. But this may have been his understanding, that Christ is incarnate throughout the world, in culture, in various forms. But you need to make a distinction between the way in which God assumed flesh in Jesus and the way in which God is incarnate in Christ. That's a hard one, because the Western mind would equate the two. Now, it could very well be that what Merton is suggesting is that Christians have too narrow a view if the only incarnation of God that there is in the world is the incarnation of God in the person of Jesus. Some people, when I first heard that, I said, that's heresy to say that. And Herbert Richardson told me, no, that's Alexandrian Christology. That has a good basis in the Church Fathers. That there is a difference between the incarnation of Christ in culture and the incarnation of God in Jesus. Now, there's no difference in Jesus. It's similar. It's the same. It's identity there. But there is another kind of, but there is difference, mental difference, intellectual difference, beyond that. The suggestion, the corollary is then, that one of the things that Christians are going to have a difficult time sustaining in the future is the idea of the chosen people. I don't know if I can follow this one at all, but I'm only reporting on what is being said. Because there is a possibility that if there's complete consistency along this line, that if God is only incarnate in Jesus, then it's only those people who are adopted into that, who are recipients of the incarnation of God, the chosen people, then it's only the church, the successor of that, which has the gifts to transmit that revelation of God to all people, and that's too narrow, and that leads to intolerance. And Merton's view may have been that it's larger than that. Christians have the revelation of Christ, he says. Christians have the revelation of Christ, but the incarnation of God is present in all cultures, but in various forms. That's a wild, wild suggestion, but it's going to be taken seriously because that allows there to be a greater kind of rapport and reciprocity between Eastern and Western religious traditions. That was the end of point three. I have to make some concluding remarks. I'll do these quickly. I guess one of the things that happens when you fiddle around with contemporary trends is that you learn much more about yourself than you learn about the trends, and you know something about where you're standing. A little bit about where you're standing. And I guess I'm no longer standing in the kind of we-they kind of relationship. I don't think my remarks, I'm just saying this so that, to temper what I've been suggesting. I don't think I'm standing kind of right in the center of the church, just kind of looking out and wondering what's going on out there. I have a feeling that I'm more out there kind of in the society and trying to figure out what's going on there. And that may be, that you may, maybe you should keep that in mind when you evaluate what is being proposed. And then the very final thing. I had a philosopher friend one time who said that after giving a very kind of exhilarating lecture about the joys of philosophy, he said, of course, none of this will do anything for you unless you get enough sleep. I think that's a truth that I would put forward with great force. But Gustav Weigel said it better. Gustav Weigel said that everything that human beings create, if given enough time, is bound to go badly. And there was comfort in that, he said.
Bound to go what?
Badly, badly. He said there's comfort in that because Saint Bernard of Clairvaux said that if God is, in some sense then the creature is not. If God is, the creature is not. Now, I remind myself of these kinds of things when I do what I did this morning, when I start speculating about the future. Because, in some ways, the future is going to be time of, the future and the present are times of great ferment, great excitement. I'm not at all pessimistic about this. At the same time, I have to remind myself that that our access to the future doesn't come through our ability to discern the trends. Our access to the future is the same as our access to the present and our access to the past. That it's based upon something much deeper than perceptiveness and discernment. Houston Smith has said about religion that what religion offers is access to the mysterious, to the more than, and to the beyond. And he said that human beings never have anything more than a very tenuous hold on any of these things. And the mysterious and the beyond and the more than are always, he calls them, diaphanous. It is sort of hovering there, and it's very hard to get hold of any of it. And that's why even this kind of exercise demonstrates to me that salvation is a gift, and it comes by grace, and it's the reality of God that pulls the entire enterprise. Anyway, that's enough for now. If anyone wants to comment or say something, I'd appreciate that.
I'd be interested a little bit about the meaning of all this for you, Chris.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
What's happened to you because this merchant
is dead? Well, I suppose when I started talking here, I guess it was 4 days ago, it seems like a couple of weeks ago now, John Schramm said that I should start out with some autobiographical remarks because people here didn't know me. And I started to do that. And then I just realized that the whole thing is autobiographical. It may be so autobiographical that it doesn't pertain to anybody other than me. You know, these are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about at the moment. But, you know, to take your question a little more seriously, I guess it's made more of a Catholic out of me. I mean, I think that'd be the first thing I'd say. I think I've become less parochial, probably less Protestant. This will spoil everything for some of you, but I don't have as high regard for Protestantism. I think Protestantism is in real trouble at the moment because it's critical. I tend to see it this way, that Christa Stendahl said that when Christianity first developed, it was Jewish self-consciousness. It was something that developed within Judaism that in the kind of fires of conflict became distended and separate, and then became conflict, and then had to become its own thing. Now that may be true about early Christianity, but it's certainly true about Protestantism, that it was Catholic self-consciousness, Christian self-consciousness, that became its own entity after a bit, and it violates my sense of the unity of all things. And I don't think the issues anymore are between Lutherans and Presbyterians or Lutherans and Methodists. I mean, it isn't that way for any student anymore. When I go into the state university, I don't represent the Lutheran point of view, although I guess I do, but it's Christian over against Buddhist. It's Christian and Buddhist over against secularism, over against Marxism. So what I think I've tried to do is to expand the basis on which my version of the version that I present regarding the nature of Christianity, the basis upon which that is based. That's a great deal of it. The other side would be...
you spend half your day meditating instead of studying.
Oh, I see what you mean.
And participating in this great knowledge search.
No, I don't think I spend half my day doing that, but I've learned how to appreciate silence. I think I talk less now than I used to. It doesn't bother me at all to sit at a meal and not have anyone speak. I know that a lot of things are going on, even when talking isn't there. It may be a temperamental thing that I've always had, but if I don't have hours of silence during the day, I can't make it. In fact, on days that are really busy, I get up early just to be sure that there is some quiet time before the day begins. I'm no example of the sort of thing I talk about. I really don't meditate with in any kind of regular fashion, but things like keeping the body under control, eating, trying to eat the proper way, I jog, that kind of stuff, all that has come out of this. I know that I would visit the monasteries periodically. I mean, I'd have to do that in order to keep going, and I do it all the time. I do it once a month, I'm sure. Because there are places nearby where I can do it, even for short periods. It's always fun to talk about yourself, I guess. I'm involved now with the... I got into this stuff early. That 2 years ago I was just beginning to do it, and I really started from zero on mystical awareness about 3 years ago, and began reading the literature. But one thing was nice about it, the literature wasn't spoiled for me. mystical literature, because I had no awareness of what it was. No one ever told me what it was about. And I didn't read any books. In fact, I've only read, I think, two or three books about mysticism in my life, and I won't read them. But I'd rather read the primary literature, the works of Bernard of Clairvaux. And I guess I'm coming up with some kind of fresh insights into that. I have one book that's coming out in October on mystical religion in the West. Another one that I'm carrying around with me. That kind of stuff has developed from it. There's the Trappist monks seem to appreciate what I've been doing in this area. They don't quite know how to transmit to the rest of the world what they think the rest of the world is looking for, because they want to live as monks. Their vocation is to live as monks. So I'm involved now in the Center for Contemplative Studies that was at Western Michigan, is now moving to the University of Dallas. And I don't know what that's going to lead to. I'm going down there at the end of September to talk about further programs. I've thought in the future there might be some way of getting the monks involved in Holden Village. It's not an unthinkable thing. They would come here, and there might be some way of not just having a discussion about contemplative religion, but actually doing it for a while, devoting 24 hours to the monastic cycle, the practice of silence. It could revolutionize things, I think. So those things are all developing.
Mm-hmm. You, you're sort of a spokesman, I believe. It'd be interesting to know, if you haven't been there, a place called Sundom, the retreat center in Lom in Gudbrandsdalen, Norway.
I haven't been there.
Silence is practiced a good deal. But my question is, a lot of times the chief sort of worries about me, some of my expeditions into strange things. Does Lois ever worry about you?
I don't know. I imagine she does, but she's here. I could ask her. No.
She's never.
Yeah, I think that's that can be a worry. I'm not in danger of running away from home and joining the monks. But in the early going on this thing, there were a lot of rough edges because I didn't know how immediately to incorporate the sort of thing that I've been kind of pursuing, almost with vengeance. I mean, it's full time for me now. There was no easy way to incorporate that into the rest of the things I was doing. I get very agitated in church. Here it happens, but very, very seldom does one ever hear a sermon that deals with any subject like this. And I think people are just wanting it. I don't think people are bad, sitting out there, and they ought to be told about how naughty they are and how willful they are in denying the things that mean. They just have not had any access to this, and what they're getting instead is kind of watered down theology, and that doesn't do anybody any good. So those kinds of things make for trouble at home, because I can't always keep the criticism under control.
For me, there's a relationship between your discussion here today and last night's discussion on family. And that is this, particularly as got into last night's discussion, single person, whether they're single through divorce or the death or never having married in the first place. I think part of the reason for a surge of interest in the kinds of things you're discussing is that there's a whole lot of people who are having to learn how to deal constructively or in a way of personal spiritual growth with solitude. And that's a whole group of people, by the way, that you really don't have to go to monasteries to find people who have tried to learn how to use solitude in their own spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. Although that's your area of study, I know. But it might be interesting someday for you or someone else to find out how those who've not chosen that as a full-time way of life have still reached a similar
could be, yeah, that's very interesting. The strategy was rather deliberate on my part. I'm interested in the survival of the Western species of humanity, and I think that I'm just guessing, or not guessing, I'm betting that that survival is based on the ongoing vitality of certain traditions. And it seems to me that this is one of the traditions, the mystical tradition, which has got shunted aside in some way, and yet it is still going on. That isn't quite true, because the reason when I really got interested in the monks was when I was wondering whatever happened to the counterculture of the 60s. And I thought that that things as powerful as the counterculture don't really die, but they may go underground for a time, and then they reemerge in a stronger way. And then it occurred to me that monasticism was the first counterculture in the West. That's really why I went out there to study it. I thought, let's see what has happened to this thing through the centuries, and maybe we can figure out what has happened to the 1960s counterculture. But it was a calculated thing to try to trace the workings of a tradition upon contemporary cultural needs and interests. Yes.
Aren't we practicing a sort of a watered-down version of monasticism by coming to holiness right here?
Well, I think this has all kinds of monastic connotations. The bells, for example, the things that are done on where the workings of the clock, matins and vespers. There are ways in which it could be much more monastic and maybe be much stronger. The use of silence, times during the day. Maybe that goes on. I haven't been here long enough to know what goes on altogether, but it could be that that the worship services, and I led one of them myself last night, should be less like lectures, less academic, less having fewer people standing up there and talking about what they think about things, and maybe providing more time for meditation or prayer. Or there are lots of ways in which the monastic tradition could influence this kind of thing, but I think it's probably monastic, kind of semi-monastic, probably non-celibate monastic in its base anyway.
I'd like to say that our group health medical place in Olympia is uses what they call relaxation response, in which they use techniques of meditation. It's kind of interesting that medicine is reaching out in that direction.
Harvard Business School is offering a course on contemplation for the first year students.
Walt, I have to say something too. It's been exceedingly helpful to me this week because I was involved with a Chicano girl. She was one of 10 children. Her mother was illiterate and she didn't know about her father. And she showed up in one of my classes. She was came as a graduate student. I couldn't understand that she would be a graduate student. And we helped her, and she eventually went through with Davis in medicine, graduated in medicine. Mm-hmm. And for her graduation gift, like it brought her up to Holden, or had her come to Holden. And she had a great experience here, but I was very concerned about her. She was raised a Catholic, and she got mixed up in this Oriental Asian religion, and I was really shook up about it. She sent me a whole raft of books I was supposed to take to hold. I haven't taken them here yet. It's a contemplation thing, and for that, I've been interested in this myself for a while, but it's really served to understand her and see where she's coming from. And she may show up again, but she writes poetry. She's a very interesting person.
Incarnation certainly is. I appreciate I'm only 68, but I'm old enough, I'm not very smart, but I'm old enough to have gone through a lot of this mystical in my own life. And I buy this idea of incarnation, but I have to warn against reincarnation. I have a son that's in a Buddhist monastery now. And I've been there. I spent a month in this Buddhist monastery in Canada, and in all these things, I think we have to have a divine kind of common sense, a sanctified common sense that learns from the mistakes of others, because we just aren't going to have time to make them all ourselves. I think Luther is a good example. He was a monastic too, and it probably was one of the best experiences of his life to let him realize about the real incarnation
of God in shoe leather and God in you and me, and if we can learn somehow, in spite of Oriental religion, and we can, I'd say to the brother, you better read those books, you might get your eyes open, and it'll help to understand, I believe, the totalness of God's whole world. I'm not just trying to survive this Western world. I'm interested in every one of God's 4 billion children. And I feel that what's good for us is good for the Oriental and vice versa. But we certainly can praise God. If we, with all our heart, seek Him, we'll surely find Him. And I've always found it through Jesus Christ.
Well, I think that's all we have time for. We have.
I just want to say, it seems to me that if you took this way of being seriously, you'd stop writing books. Now, I say it very cryptically in order to bring out a point. It seems to me our whole way of life is so different from this way of being that we are always making and shaping, and there you're receiving. And if you somehow you can reach the depth of your being, you are. You don't have to make yourself. And we are making ourselves by the doing of things and the writing of books and all that kind of thing.
But we must be witnesses even if we're Oriental religion.
Isn't there a danger of syncretism here?
You know, I thought it was coffee break time for myself. If anybody, I'm ready for more, but if,
danger of what?
Syncretism.
What is that?
Syncretism of all the religious traditions.